The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Urban Helen asked me what the topic of my talk is, and I couldn't tell her because it's just not that sort of, I'm not there in that kind of concise, precise way. However, I do have something to say. That's a good thing. And what I have been looking at lately in my meditation are two ideas that seem to be in contrast to each other. They conflict with each other. So I thought I would use these two ideas and explore them coming together, separating, coming together, and separating. Because that's what they do, in fact, in reality. One of them is our effort to give ourselves an identity or to create ourselves as a something. That's one idea. And that I find a fundamental action that we do within that is that we're grasping for existence. It's very basic to who we are. And it's something that's natural, and it's also basic to who we are as human beings. So that's one thing. We're struggling to make ourselves into something. The second thought was, I was listening to a Dharma talk by River Master Jiu, and I came across a sentence, and when I heard it, I went, thank you. Yes, that's what I wanted to hear. And what she said is that the child of the Lord, or our deepest longing, is wishing to cease being individual and wishing to be one with Buddha nature. So how is it that we do the struggle for existence or the struggle to come up with an identity and also cherish and honor that deepest longing that we all have to become one with our eternal nature? So that's what I want to look at today. Well, the first thing is that is wishing to cease being individual. It has an attraction for me in that being individual to me means being separate, separating ourselves off, or separating ourselves from something else. And the wish to cease from being an individual tells me that being an individual isn't very satisfying or isn't something that we can really take refuge in, that we can rely on. And what happens is our ideas of separating ourselves is that very thing that causes us suffering. How is that? When we have such a natural, deep draw to be somebody, to have an existence, to identify ourselves, how is it that that idea of separation causes us problems? I feel that the craving we have for existence is not something we can get rid of with training, or is it something that's desirable to get rid of? Craving is something that we do. We need to do that. But the word craving is in of itself problematic when it becomes harmful, when it starts to become a focused way of doing things that starts to have a hard edge to it and starts to become very intense and becomes exclusive to other ideas and other ways of doing things. So it becomes very narrow. So craving can become an obstacle for us. And a hard edge can appear when we find ourselves craving to give ourselves an identity. A hard edge can be a clue when you find yourself saying, I have to, I must, this is right, or this is wrong. And words like that can be a red flag that we're insisting on something that is crucial to the identification of a self, ourselves. And I looked up the word attachment, and I like to look up the root definitions of words sometimes, and this one interested me. The word attachment, the root definition means a stake, or to hear or fasten yourself to something. That's a strong statement. It's not just a lightweight sort of thing, but it's like to, you know, rope and tie yourself to a stake, or, you know, to fasten yourself with Gorilla Glue, you know, something like that. So it's not something that we want to it's not a gentle thing. It's something that becomes hard and rigid and set. And I was looking at a way to further explain these two ideas of wishing to become one with the eternal and our lives that just seem to be, in my mind, uncomfortable. And one of the ways that I found is that is through simple math. I don't know about you, but I often find that in my life, I come into situations and I find that 1 + 1 = 3. And I don't quite know what has happened in these situations sometimes. Sometimes I do. But I don't, I feel like things just don't quite add up. And I don't know about for you, but the more I look at things, not with a judgmental, critical mind, but just look at things, I find that there isn't a whole lot that is satisfying in a refuge kind of way, deeply satisfying. And that's my take on it. Anyway, so if 1 + 1 = 3, things do not quite add up. And I find there is something missing, there is an incompletion. And of course, what I want to do is to fill that void. I want to find myself, or I find myself saying, I would like to know what I could do better, or what went wrong, or what I could have brought to the situation that would have been more satisfying for myself and other people. And this is part of our practice, too, to look at these things and to do something about that. And I don't feel that we can ever get to the place where everything in this way, in this worldly way, where we're trying to identify ourselves and use that self to make everything right. I personally don't think that we can achieve that. It's actually a trap sometimes to try and to do better because we're trying to fix things, we're trying to control things, we're trying to contain things, and it just really is oftentimes futile effort. And the reason I say that is not because we don't do it, not because we weren't going to do it, but that we just don't seem to have the capability of coming up with something that's truly effective. I'm pretty stubborn and I want to find something else. One thing I reflected on was that our Western classical music is so satisfying, and the reason is because you have all these beautiful notes and everything, and you have discords and things go up and down, notes go up and down. And then finally, oftentimes, you come to the very end note, and there's a resolution there. Musically, there's a resolution, and that is that pleasing, that moment when you can go, you know, everything's comfortable there for just a moment. But it's, we do want that and seek that in our lives. Part of the goal, or part of the way of finding an identification for ourselves, or an identity, like an identity tag, is that we have goals that our culture has almost insisted on us looking into and achieving. Goals like happiness, money, you know, good reputation, things like that. We spend an awful lot of time trying to satisfy that goal. And what happens is that we are placing the meaning of our lives in pursuit of these things of happiness, what others think of us, good reputation, and money, if that's what we're after. And what we are doing, in fact, is we're setting up and comparing our present lives with these goals. And that's where the problem is. There's a gap. Because we have an idea of what things should be, and we aren't really accepting things for what they are. And that conflict, again, is, you know, what I started to talk about, is the trying to identify as ourselves. Because if we can accomplish a goal of, say, happiness or good reputation, that can be, you know, that's its own struggle for existence, as I would say. But the problem is that we aren't accepting who we are. We're not really being kind to ourselves or showing ourselves, giving ourselves the compassion of who we are and the situation we are. That's a difficult thing to do, and it takes a lot of courage, and it is not the way of the world. It is not what most people do. So that means that what we do, if we do choose to find something that is truly satisfying, we go against the grain of what most of the world believes in. And the problem with the goals is not the goals themselves. It's fine to have money or, you know, whatever, good reputation. It's the wanting that causes us suffering. And I think most of us can recognize when we are wanting something or when we're needy. And I find myself in situations that I will be needy and I don't even recognize it. But then just in my conversation with other people, I see that there's something that they're responding to me in a different way. And that for me is a clue. And I don't even see it sometimes. But then I'll say, oh, I must be really tired and I just feel needy in a certain way that is not good for myself or other people. So I do my best to redirect myself and just be quiet and accept that, you know, whatever's going on, the reason for my neediness, it's okay. And then I can accept whatever it is that I see is causing that neediness, whether it's being tired or, you know, not getting what I want or whatever. So what we're doing is we're setting ourselves up, in contrast to these goals. And that's where conflict arises. And what happens is by doing that, we're not giving ourselves a chance to give ourselves, our lives, true expression. And this is from Refining Your Life, Uchiyama. He says, since we are only who we are, we become lonely by trying to make ourselves into something we are not. What is vital here is that you give expression to the flower of your meditation and allow it to blossom as completely and as naturally as it can in every moment of your life. That flower of meditation, that flower of here and now, is your life. It's not like it's something else, but it's what's going on with us right now. And here's another equation that I thought was interesting to me. It's basic math. 1 + 1 = 0. This one I like. Okay. Because 0 is an interesting number for those people who have studied math. It's infinite. We all know that. But its infinity is the smallest. It goes to the smallest, and it doesn't ever end. But it also goes to the largest, and it never is. There's no such thing as the largest when it comes to infinity. So what you have with infinity is you have the very smaller, so very small things, and you have the very big things all wrapped up into this big zero, zero. And what I like about it is it really presents to me that there is a universal reality too. And it's not just what we think or have what our opinions are about. And within that universal is the capability or potential for other possibilities, unfathomable possibilities. And that points me to going beyond trying to hold on so tightly to my views and opinions. Because if they're in the context of the universe, things change a little bit. I don't think that I'm the center of the universe or that my ideas are so important. But in the context of the universe, things shift. We all live in worlds, both the worlds of dissatisfaction, of trying to continually identify ourselves as well as the world of the universe. But in fact, they aren't two, they're only one. Now I'm going to switch gears and tell you a story. And this story is a story of history. And I've heard, I don't know how many times in my life, that history repeats itself. So you can expect people that are warring. Well, you, of course, that happens because history repeats itself. Okay. So this story I found in a book, and I'll tell you what it is in a bit, but I'm going to tell you the story first. It's called How to Stop an Insurgency. This story's on a scale that isn't about just you or I and you, who you and I encounter on a one-to-one basis or in a small group like this. This is a story about a nation that was threatened in 1975 in the Southeast Asia. And it's when the communists in Thailand were threatening to overrun the government. And at that time, Cambodia and Laos and South Vietnam were all involved in this movement of communism overtaking those countries. But this story is different. And it's not too many people know about it according to what is written in this article. And it's this true story. Okay. So what has the story is that during 1975, the Thai government recognized that if they didn't do something, that the country would be in war. And they didn't want that. So what happened is they came up with a 3-point strategy that was really radical. And it was supported by the king, and the king used his own finances to actually help have this movement come about. So there were communists threatening in the north part of the country, and the Thai people knew who they were, because what happened was that the communists were Thai people. It was young people, a lot of them university students, who were fed up with the government. So they went into the hills, into the mountains of Thailand, and they got arms and learned their military training from a different country, and I don't know who that is, maybe China, I'm not sure. But so they were communist guerrillas, and they were becoming a force to contend with. And the reason it was because in these remote areas, the villagers were supporting the communists. So it was something that the government had to look at and to say, this is a real possibility that we could have a war on our hand, and a lot of people would be killed. So what they did, excuse me, this was a real danger. This is a real threat. It wasn't just something that was a potential. And the writer of this was a forest monk at the time. And so he was out walking through these forests where all this was going on. And this is his story. And that's why, and he says, this was what he saw and what he experienced. So it isn't something that he read about and put something together. This was his own experience. And this was in like 1979 and 1980. So first what happened is that the government found a solution of restraint. Instead of going after and attacking the communists, the military did not attack. Though everybody knew where the enemy was. So that was one thing they did. They didn't attack. So there wasn't this confrontation of them and us, and you know, getting the money together, and you know, getting the buying the guns and doing all that stuff. They didn't do it at all. So there was no confrontation, no action of attack. So there was none of that. The second thing was that they forgave all the people that were the young Thai communists. And gave him an unconditional amnesty. So what they did with that is they gave these young people a chance to change their minds and come back into the Thai culture with honor and respect and without retaliation. So that was the second thing that was done. And what happened is the restraint helped the young communists, who were very angry about the government, that's what prompted this whole thing, to not making their anger worse. It didn't fix it, but it just didn't exasperate or, you know, irritate that anger that was already inflamed. The third strategy was solving the root problem. And this is where the king of Thailand used his own finances to build new roads, and he constructed water reservoirs with connected irrigation schemes and brought electricity to very remote hamlets and villages. And with the new roads, the people that were very poor now had roads to go to sell their produce in town, you know, because they were farmers, they were agricultural people that depended on growing food for their existence. So now they had a way to get their food to town. And then the second thing was that, the reservoirs then allowed the farmers to have two crops a year. So they had twice as much available food a year. So that was the second thing. And then with having electricity, they could bring in schools and medical clinics to these remote areas. So what happened is the government was actually helping people out in the poor country, and these were the people that were supporting the communists. And then after a while, Let me read this. So one by one, they gave up their guns and returned. This was the communists, young communists, returned to their families at their village or their university. By the early 1980s, there were hardly any insurgents left. So then the generals of the jungle army, the leaders of the communists, also gave themselves up. So this had an effect. There were some changes going on that seemed to be beneficial. And then the leaders of the insurgency, what happened to them? Because you had the soldiers were there, they didn't have any more people to lead. The generals didn't. And so could the same unconditional offer of amnesty be applied to them? Not quite. But they were not punished, not exiled. Instead, they were offered important positions of responsibility in the Thai government service in recognition of their leadership qualities, capacity for hard work, and concern for their people. Smart move, huh? What a brilliant gesture. Why waste the resource of such courageous and committed young men? By the time the book was written, 2004, two of those former communist leaders were serving their country as ministers in the Thai national government. So in my mind, that was a real effective change. And, you know, we just don't hear about stories like that ever. I mean, it's not about ever, but it's very, very rare that people would take on a situation that is potentially very threatening and do something that is not going to battle, to combat that, confront that, you know. And I say to myself, what prevents us more of these events, a kind of events from happening? And again, we create our own world. And we create it by the things that we encounter in our daily lives. We can't prevent ourselves from creating the things that come up. But it's possible to realize that the world of our creation does not reflect all the possibilities or true reality. By practicing this realization, we can let go of our rigid belief in narratives and preferences of our minds, and we can open ourselves up to much more than our thoughts and feelings. And just by saying this possibility exists or maybe exists, just entertaining that this is something that could be, is enough to turn ourselves in another direction. When we add something to what already is, like a strong attitude or an opinion, we miss the opportunity to recognize or be aware that we are already suffused with that which our hearts long to be one with. We already are one with the universal Buddha nature, and we just need to believe that. Thank you.